There is a wonder and a mystery to any spiritual ritual. Certainly that is true of Holy Communion. The realization that we come to the elements of the Lord's table and we hold in our hand that which symbolizes the body of Jesus Christ, God's Son. And then we hold in a cup the symbol of his shed blood for our redemption. I find that as often as I have participated and partaken, that I have never fully comprehended the significance, nor the magnificence, nor the mystery. But before we come to the magnificence and the mystery of the communion table, let's first go back to the Old Testament, to the worship of God as explained in our continuing study of Exodus, looking this morning at chapters 28 through 31. And as we do, we seek to witness some of the magnificence and some of the mystery of the rituals of the Old Covenant. For it is in these chapters that we are given a glimpse of the worship of God in the tabernacle of ancient Israel. It begins by telling us about the priest who served in that tabernacle, and specifically in chapter 28 of Exodus, in the beginning of that chapter, about the garments which were prepared for them to wear. These are the words that God spoke to Moses. "Then bring near to you Aaron your brother, and his sons with him, from among the people of Israel, to serve me as priests. Aaron and Aaron's sons, Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar. And you shall make holy garments for Aaron your brother, for glory and for beauty. And you shall speak to all who have ability, whom I have endowed with an able mind, that they make Aaron's garments to consecrate him for my priesthood. These are the garments which they shall make: a breastpiece, an ephod, a robe, a coat of checker work, a turban and a girdle. They shall make holy garments for Aaron your brother and his sons to serve me as priests." These vestments that the high priest was to wear were magnificent, and rightly so, for the high priest was to be the representative of the people to God. He was to step into the presence of God, particularly on that high and holy day of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, and was to present the blood to God that was from the animal sacrifice for the sin of the people. It's no wonder that he was to be spectacularly dressed for the role which he was to play. He wore an ephod, a piece of cloth front and back gathered at the waist with two shoulder straps that held it together. And on each of these shoulder straps at the top, there was an onyx stone on which was engraved on each one six of the 12 tribes of Israel. So that as he would step into those holy places and as he would perform the rituals of worship, there would be a constant reminder that those tribes stood before God symbolized by him. Perhaps more interesting was the breastpiece. That was a 9-inch square piece of cloth that hung on the high priest's chest, suspended by gold chains that were around his neck. On the outside of it, there were 4 rows of 3 stones each, for a total of 12, and engraved on each one of those stones was one of the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. But maybe more interesting was what was inside that breastpiece, for when it was made into a pouch, inserted in it was the Urim and the Thummim. We don't know a great deal about what that was or how it worked. We do understand that it was the supernatural means by which God communicated his will to the leadership of Israel. Some people have speculated that it was something like dice, so that, say, Moses would go and he would have some moral issue or question or some issue about a battle to be fought or a route to be taken in the journey. And it could not be discerned by the other revelations of God, nor by ordinary human wisdom. And so he would go to Aaron the high priest and he would ask this question. Ask it in a yes or no fashion. The Urim and Thummim will be taken out of the breastpiece and laid on the table, and the way that it would appear on the table would be the means by which God would communicate the decision that he would make for the people in the decision that was before them. Under all of this, the high priest wore a blue robe, a robe that went from head to almost toe, and around its hem was a series alternating between pomegranates and bells. Those bells enabled all those who were part of the temple, the tabernacle worship, to know exactly where the high priest was at any moment as he walked about. That was particularly interesting when he walked into the Holy of Holies on the Day of Atonement, where no one else could go there. And in that shrouded darkness, it would be impossible to see or to know exactly what the high priest was doing or where he was. But as he moved about, there was silence when he stopped, and there was sound when he moved, and it could be understood exactly how he was going through the rituals of worship. Now, here in chapter 28, we're also told about his clothes and his girdle, his turban. Even the undergarments were prescribed as to exactly what the high priest was to wear, how they were to be prepared, and all of the other things as part of his vestments of worship. But most noteworthy was a gold plate that the high priest had attached to his turban, to his hat. And there, in Hebrew characters, were the words translated into English, meaning holy to the Lord. As it flashed in the sunlight, or as the priest attached it and wore it, he knew, and everyone knew, that his function was special. Not because he was better than anyone else, and certainly not because he was perfect, for the high priest was a sinner just like everyone else was a sinner, but he was holy, meaning set apart, or separated to God for a specific role and a specific function. Well, he was to be ordained as well, and that's explained in chapter 29. The backdrop of this is that in ancient Israel, in former days, the eldest male of the family, usually the father of the household, served as a priest for the entire family or clan. But when God organized Israel into a nation, he set aside certain people to serve certain functions for the entire nation of Israel. There were 13 tribes of Israel, 12 of them called territorial tribes because they had land given to them, and one non-territorial tribe called Levi. It was the responsibility of the members of the tribe of Levi to do the work of the tabernacle and later of the temple. So Levi was separated out from all the other tribes, and out of Levi was chosen one family, the family of Aaron, the brother of Moses. Aaron was to be the first high priest. His sons after him, and their sons after them, were to serve all of the priestly functions of ancient Israel, and there was to be a line of succession from Aaron onward where one would be the high priest. Exodus 29 tells about their ordination. Now this is what you shall do to them to consecrate them, that they may serve me as priests. Take one young bull and two rams without blemish, and unleavened bread, unleavened cakes mixed with oil, and unleavened wafers spread with oil. You shall make them of fine wheat flour, and you shall put them in one basket, and bring them in the basket, and bring the bull and the two rams. You shall bring Aaron and his sons to the door of the tent of meeting and wash them with water. And you shall take the garments, and put on Aaron the coat, and the robe of the ephod, and the ephod, and the breastpiece, and gird him with the skillfully woven band of the ephod. And you shall set the turban on his head, and put the holy crown upon the turban. And you shall take the anointing oil, and pour it on his head, and anoint him. Then you shall bring his sons, and put coats on them, and you shall gird them with girdles, and bind caps on them, and the priesthood shall be theirs by a perpetual statute. Thus you shall ordain Aaron and his sons. The rest of the chapter explains a four-step process. First, washing. Second, anointing with oil. Third, the sacrifices of the animals. And fourth, the anointing with blood. And then he was a priest. And that was reckoned to be a high and a holy privilege. You see, not everyone had access to God. Not everyone could talk to him. Not everyone could be with him. Not everyone could receive his word or his revelation. Only a few. And the priests were the few. It was indeed a mighty and an awesome role that they were to play, a privilege that the ordinary Hebrew did not have. Well, Exodus goes on from priests to procedures. In chapter 30, in verses 1 through 10, we're told about the altar of incense. It added a special fragrance to the tabernacle worship. Every morning, first thing, Aaron got up, went in, and burned incense, the fragrance of which filled the tabernacle. And every evening, the last thing he did was to burn incense. There are lots of guesses and interpretations as to why God asked this, but we're never told in the Bible. Now, I find that kind of a commentary on life. There are lots of things that happen to me and happen to other people for which I yearn to find an explanation. It is not so troublesome to me that some people have difficulties and others don't, that life has its ups and downs, its trials and its thrills. I think what I most struggle with is not knowing why. And there's been many a time when I, for myself or someone else, have asked God, don't change it, just explain it. Help me see why I've got what I've got. Help me understand why she's going through what she's going through. And God, like with the altar of incense, is silent. And it is more the silence of God than the circumstances of life that troubles me. But there's a lesson in that too. The lesson that God is not obligated to explain everything that happens to us. That he is a God who sometimes calls upon us simply in faith to accept the realities which are ours and allow the good reasons for them to be held in the secrets of the mind of the Almighty. So it was for that altar of incense. At least we might guess from it that God was sufficiently concerned about the details of worship that he took note not only of the sights and the sounds, but even the smells that wafted through the tabernacle. In verses 11 through 16 of Exodus 20, the procedure goes from altar of incense to census. Now, census was a rather irregular occurrence in ancient times. Many of those peoples, the Jews as well as those nations around them, were reluctant to count the people for fear that they were messing where only God ought tread. The idea was that if they had an idea exactly how many people there were in the nation, that they would then become proud of that. Perhaps they would count their soldiers and then enter into wars where they ought not go. Or perhaps that they would become proud of the huge number of their nation as they multiplied out. And that with that information and with that pride would potentially come their downfall. I understand that because I think that there's some parallels for us as well. Within the Church of Jesus Christ, we are tempted many times to count. You may or may not know that in a service like this, and in each of our services, one of the responsibilities of our ushers is to count how many of us there are here. And that also can become a source of pride, that we think that because we have more that we are better, or that we think that because of the resources we have, we are capable of doing things to which God has not called us. So there is a measure of wisdom in the ways of those ancient peoples. In this case, it was God himself who ordered the census. Maybe not so much for the count, but for the commitment. You see, everyone 20 and up was to be included in the census. Those who had not reached the age of majority were not counted. And everyone who was included in the census was not only to be numbered and named, but also was required to give a half shekel census tax. Up until this time, the people of Israel could stay back in anonymity in the crowd. But this time, for the first time, they had to step forward and be counted, had to become involved, no longer able to allow the worship of God to be held by a select few. Everyone was to be incorporated. And so the census took place with the half shekel tax. A reminder that spectators seeking anonymity from worship would not be appropriate for a God who claimed them all to be part of his covenant. Chapter 30, verses 17 to 21. Tell about the laver. We talked last Sunday morning about the various pieces of furniture in the tabernacle, and here one is added to the list. It was a wash basin where the priests regularly washed themselves, symbolic of the necessity to be pure and spiritually clean before God. Look at verse 20. Verse 20 says that if those priests don't wash themselves, they will die. That sounds more like something the mother of a three-year-old would say than something that God would say to a priest. You know, if you don't wash your hands, you're dead. And we read things like this. In fact, some people belittle the Bible for the extremities to which God seems to go. But there's a statement that is here made as well. It is a statement that God is the one who prescribes the form of worship. He is the one who says it's to be done this way or it is to be done that way. By the way, there is never a record in the Bible or elsewhere of God ever striking anyone dead because they did not appropriately wash their hands. Apparently, the warning was sufficient that they did what they were supposed to do. But the greater point is that God determines how we should be worshipped. We don't do it as the worshippers. he does it is the one who is worthy of the worship to be received. Verses 34 to 38 in Exodus 30 tell about the incense and even give a recipe on how it should be prepared. And then another interesting statement. In verse 37, the incense which you shall make, according to its composition, you shall not make for yourself. It shall be for you holy to the Lord. Saying that this recipe was exclusively to be used for the worship of Yahweh God. They could not make it to be burned in their tents. They could not form it together and carry it in their pouches or their pockets for burning somewhere out in the wilderness. This was God's and God's alone. So that in his worship there are some things that he keeps to himself. And again, it is God who prescribes the ways and the means and the procedures of worship and not those who worship him. Chapter 31 continues to tell about these procedures, raising the question of who's going to do all this with the elaborate instructions that are given through these old and lengthy chapters of the Bible. And with the worship preparation completed, God appoints the workers, the people who are to make it all happen. And it reads like this. The Lord said to Moses, "See, I have called by name Bezalel, the son of Uri, the son of Hur." Let me just interject here that the Hebrew word for son of is Ben. So in Hebrew, this reads Ben-Hur, from which I assume comes the title of the story and the title of the movie, Ben-Hur. That has absolutely nothing to do with this or my reading it, but I thought that would be of interest to you. Anyway, verse 2 says, "See, I have called by name Bezalel, the son of Uri, Ben-Hur, of the tribe of Judah, and I have filled him with the Spirit of God, with ability and intelligence, with knowledge and all craftsmanship, to devise artistic designs, to work in gold, silver, and bronze, in cutting stones for setting, and in carving wood for work in every craft. And behold, I have appointed with him Aholiab, the son of Ahisamach, of the tribe of Dan. And I have given to all able men ability that they may make all that I have commanded you." And then the list of what's commanded. And then the end of verse 11. "According to all that I have commanded, they shall do." All of those here selected immediately face the question. Can they work on the Sabbath day? Oh, sure. God has said in the Ten Commandments that one day a week was to be taken off as a day of rest. And on that day, they couldn't do their work. On that day, it was illegal to raise the crops or feed the animals or prepare the meals or clean the house. But what about the Lord's work? On the Sabbath day, was it okay to build the tabernacle? And that's explained in these final verses 12 to 18 of chapter 31. We're told in verse 13, "You shall keep my Sabbath, for this is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I, the Lord, sanctify you." In other words, God's rules apply even to God's work. Sometimes those of us who are deeply involved in the work of Jesus Christ and the Church of Jesus Christ somehow think that we do not have all of the rules applicable to us. There are those who say, well, God doesn't take a day off, so I ought not take a day off either. But the truth of it is that God's rules apply not only to our labors, but to our labors that are on his behalf as well. We read all this, and it becomes quickly apparent that we are 3,500 years away in time from these old chapters and old ways of doing things. But it becomes even more apparent that we are farther away in our procedures of worship. We don't sacrifice animals. We don't take out sheep and goats and rams and slaughter them. We don't have to. Because Jesus Christ is our sacrifice. He died on the cross and by his shed blood paid the penalty for sin once and for all so there need never again be an animal sacrifice. We today, we don't have priests. We don't have to. Because in the New Testament we are told that everyone who is a Christian, every believer in Jesus Christ is a priest. A priest to God. Think of that. That means if you're a Christian, you are a priest. You have the same direct access to God that the high priest had back here in Exodus, and there's no longer any necessity for any of us to have anyone else who stands between us and God. We have direct access to him. We no longer have this old covenant. It has been replaced by the new covenant, the New Testament of Jesus Christ. And so we say, I mean, what does all this stuff have to do with us? These priests and these procedures and these chapters of the Bible that I find interesting at best and boring more often than interesting. What does it have to do with me? While the priests and the procedures may be of another generation and era, the principles very much apply to us today. The principle woven through these chapters that God is worth the very best. You see it again and again, the very best for God, the best jewels, the best cloth. The animals for sacrifice had to be without blemish. The top workers, the most skilled of the entire nation. Repeatedly, there's a call for skilled work, for pure oil, for finest of spices, for fragrance, the most fragrant incense. You see, they gave their very, very best to God. Because God was worth the very, very best. I think today that we don't always live by that principle. Too often we give to God when we come to Him in prayer the most tired minutes of our day. When we come to God with our offerings, we give to Him the leftovers after all the other bills have been paid and all the other priorities met. Of our skills and our talents, we provide the very best for our occupations, for our paychecks, and don't always think that most of all, first of all, we ought to give our skills and our talents to God. You see, God deserves the very, very best that we have. Our brightest minds, our best years, our highest talents, our most valued possessions. He deserves the very, very best. That's not an unreasonable expectation from God, because God has given to us His very best. For God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son. And He who has given His best to us ought to receive our best in return. Let me lay a challenge on you. That you and I quit giving less than our best to God. That we believe, that we say, and that we practice that God is worth the very best we have. There's also the principle here that God delights in beauty. I'm fascinated by the words already read in Exodus 28:2. God saying that you shall make holy garments for Aaron your brother for the glory and for the beauty. God is a lover of beauty. Clearly that stuff. We can look outside to the beauty of the skies. We can see the magnificent mountains He has created. We can take a glance at the rolling sea or even the delicate flower or the variety of animals. God is the master artist, not of a generation or an era. He is the master artist of all of time and all of the universe. And He loves beauty. He has made beautiful things for us to behold and for His own enjoyment as well. And so He thrills for us also to bring to Him and for Him that which is beautiful. Something that our generation, perhaps in our self-centeredness, has too often forgot. We are not likely today to build cathedrals for God's glory and for a present of beauty to Him. We think of music more as entertainment than as expressions of worship to a God who loves that which is magnificent and that which is beautiful. We forget sometimes that God thrills to the best of music and of art and of literature, and that we ought to do it not for the buck nor even for our own benefit, but that we do it for God and His glory. Because He is the God of aesthetic beauty. What do you say we change our attitude about that too? What do you say that we decide that we will seek to be creators of beauty for the glory and for the delight of God? There's yet another principle here. It is one that I think of often and helps me greatly. It is the principle that God gives the resources to meet His expectations. When you read through Exodus, you cannot help but think that God had extraordinary expectations of those people. Keep in mind that they had just come out of slavery, where they were laborers, where they did the coarsest of work and not the finest of work, where they were the poorest of people and had few resources. And yet God asked them to do things that required great skills and craftsmanship and tremendous resources in gold and silver, in brass, in precious stones. How could God expect so much of us? Ah, but it's clear. We read about Aholiab, and we read about the other artisans that God provided and gave all the skills and all of the talents that were necessary, given to us the principle that God always provides the resources necessary for the expectations to be met. And that's what he does for us as well. He gives to us expectations, but he also gives to us the resources to meet those expectations. What do you say? What about deciding to give God the very, very best? Because he's worth the best. Provide for him that which is beautiful because he's a lover of beauty. And trust him, soaring to the highest of expectations, absolutely convinced that God will always provide the resources to meet the expectations that he has of us. After all, how can we give less than our best to the one who gave us his very best, his own time?